Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of insects with our guest entomologist, Phil Pelletieri. And we can talk about all kinds of insects on the show today. Maybe box elder bugs or Asian lady beetles or stink bugs. All kinds of things to deal with. Phil's a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. He retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. Been a guest with us for many years, and it's always fun to have him with us. And I hope you'll join in with your questions for Phil. Tell us maybe how you make your firewood free of critters, or what are your home remedies for dealing with infestations. Join the conversation. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Nice to be here. How are you doing, Larry?
I'm doing well. I was thinking about the fact that my fireplace is gas, and I do not have firewood. And somebody asked me about, or was commenting about, insects that came in with their firewood. And I said, I don't have that problem. But what about insects and firewood? How do you keep them out?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is most of the trees we cut down are dead and dying, and often they have critters in them to begin with. And then if you store the wood inside or it warms up, the insects wake up and emerge. Now, the good news is most of that stuff is just nuisance-type critters. In some very well-seasoned firewood, there could be powder post beetles, but I generally don't see that. The problem is, if you knew this was coming, what I would suggest in the summer is to tarp the firewood to get it to heat up to a point that it would probably both drop the moisture and often kill the insects right there. But, you know, it's kind of a good rule of thumb to bring in maybe a week's worth or so, if possible, or less. Now, I've said that to people way up north, and they laugh at me because, as you know, if the snow gets deep and whatnot, it makes life problematic. So I said, the good news is it's mostly a nuisance problem, but you do got to be careful because, as I said, the kind of wood that we're harvesting for firewood is exactly the kind of wood that would have, especially beetles, sometimes carpenter ants, and sometimes just a few critters hiding under the bark to spend the winter.
Yeah. Well, Joe in Two Harbors, Minnesota, already has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have taken Dr. Pelletieri's advice over the previous years, and it's been great for cluster flies. So I've always sprayed in late August with bifenthrin, and then in the spring I've had no emergence. However, in the last 2 years, I've still come back to my cabin and found cluster flies. And this year, I sprayed very conscientiously, and it was kind of cool. And as you know, we suddenly had a warm spell here about a week ago.
Yeah.
And they all came out again. And my question is, am I doing something wrong? And should I be using something other than bifenthrin? But it's the only thing that I can find. It's in an ortho product called Home Defense.
Yeah.
What does the good doctor think?
Okay, so your timing is good. I mean, the problem with fall critters is that different ones come in at different times. And cluster flies tend to be end of August, beginning September, whereas Asian lady beetles we might not see until you have a hard freeze, so it could even be a couple weeks from now. All the chemicals that we're using right now for outdoor control are bifenthrin or bifenthrin's first cousins. They're all synthetic pyrethroids. The one thing that is a little frustrating when you go to the hardware store is the chemicals you buy could be the same chemical, but they're formulated somewhat differently than the ones that the pest control companies would use. They tend to get products that have extended outdoor life. They're microencapsulated or formulated in a different way. Now, you can get those products, but you have to chase them down. You usually will not find those at the hardware store. You have to go and order them on these do-your-own pest control sites and those kind of things. And so it's the same chemicals that the professionals would use. The only difference is, again, is how well they stick. And so that is a partial concern. The other thing, though, is, you know, I think your window is as good as it could be, but what might explain part of it is that some of the cluster flies might have already moved into the cracks and crevices before you treated. And then, that's the frustration. When critters get into wall voids and attics and whatever, they're really not worth trying to spray because you can't get to them. That's a little bit of a long shot because, like I said, everything else you're telling me is pretty good, and especially since you had success with the bifenthrin that you used before. But as I said, if I had to buy something, I would purposely look for something that has a longer life. And then with cluster flies, you know, it's always high, you know, overhangs, cracks around windows and the like. I really don't worry about them sneaking in at ground level because that is not their behavior. They usually sit on the sides of the building when it warms up, and then they crawl upwards, and that's what gets them underneath the seams and stuff and gets us into the structure.
Yeah. Joe, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Cheryl in Mount Horeb next. Hi, Cheryl.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm calling with a question about ground bees.
Okay.
I've been doing some fall cleanup, and I wasn't aware there was a ground bee nest in one of the beds, and they were attacking. So I would be interested in knowing how I can eradicate that nest. Thank you.
Two things. Sorting through. Bumblebees will nest in the ground. You know, those are the dark, fuzzy, yellow, and black critters. What a lot of people call ground bees are usually paper wasps and yellow jackets that nest in the ground in similar kind of structures as the bumblebees. The thing about the yellow jackets is they're going to be done very quickly. They freeze out. The only way they survive is the new queens go crawl under a rock somewhere and spend the winter and start everything from scratch. And usually when we get it around the 1st of November, it's kind of the shutoff date. Now, if you had to do something, because you just got to work in that part of the garden for now and the like. And the first thing is if you could pick cool mornings, and when we start getting cool mornings, they shouldn't really be active below 40 degrees. So that sometimes helps. But for treating ground nests, I'm much more of a proponent of using a dust rather than a spray. What has been quite frustrating to me is back in the day, all the years that I ran the lab, if you were to call me, I'd say there's a carbaryl dust, typically sold under the name 7, that really works quite well for this. The problem now is if you go buy 7 at the hardware store, it's not carbaryl, it's a different chemical, which does not work quite as well, and I can speak to that from my own attempts of trying to use it. But still, dusts are better than anything else. And one of the things you can consider, because the colony's got to be quite weak right now, you might even be able to just bury it without even treating it. When they're really strong and there's a couple thousand individuals, they can kind of dig their way out of things. But they've been in decline. Food is in short supply. And as I said, the colonies kind of die out from starvation, among other things. So I said, you might just consider getting some dirt. A cool morning would be a good time to treat it, or right at dusk, and pack it in a little bit, and then maybe if that will solve it. If it's bumblebees, I'd say leave them alone. They are not aggressive. What you find with bumblebee nests, you can work around them and they won't bother you. But they're also in decline now. It's late enough. In fact, some bumblebees basically have been gone for a good 4 or 5 weeks now because they end their populations in September. Even the ones that hang on now, I do see quite a bit of bumblebee activity in my backyard. But I don't get too concerned. But again, if you really had to, I think filling the nest would work.
All right. There you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Jeff emailed us. Jeff's neighbor has vinyl cedar shake siding on the rear of their home. This time of year, box elderbugs seem to crawl out from under the siding panels. How can this be stopped or treated?
Well, box elderbugs open a couple extra doors for us. One of the nice things is that they are susceptible to soap sprays. The limitation of soap sprays is if the box elderbugs are out when you spray them, they're dead. but if they're hiding under the siding and walk out 20 minutes later, they're not. Versus the chemicals, like we spoke earlier for cluster flies, the outdoor chemicals that are all synthetic pyrethroids, usually have anywhere from 5 days to 2 months worth of residual. So if you go through the bother of spraying those, I'm a little interested. Generally, box elder bugs are a native critter. They usually do better in dry late summers. The reason for that, there's a fungus disease that naturally controls them if it's wet. Now, in the southern part of the state, we have been really quite dry for the last 5 or 6 weeks, but we were wet earlier. I have not seen a lot of them in my wanderings around, but that does not mean that they're not hot spots elsewhere. And again, what you're witnessing is exactly what they do. They crawl underneath things. If it finally gets cold, they stay there. But if it warms up, they kind of wake up and move around again. If they are not finding the way into the structure, that tells me that the walls are sealed quite well, which is good. And then it's just an outside nuisance. Where it gets to be problematic is if they can crawl into the wall voids and then they show up through light fixtures and stuff. And just like all these fall invading critters get to be a nuisance all winter long. But the window of them coming in is always September and October for most of them.
There you go. Patty in Barneville has a question or a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I have a raspberry patch, and they're the fall variety, and I can hardly pick them because they're so full of bees, and I think it's a honeybee. And is there anything I can do to stop them from eating all of the berries? I did put sugar water in my bird bath, and some go there, but they are a nuisance, and they sting when you're trying to pick them, and yeah, they're pretty aggressive right now.
I would be suspicious more that they're yellow jackets of one sort or another, because honeybees typically look for the nectar of flowers. They're not interested in overly ripe fruit. But the thing about yellow jackets is they have a fondness for both protein and sugar and the high sugar content of the berries. So that's not unusual. And it really is a problem because even if I could come up with a magic spray, any magic spray you use has a harvest restriction, depending on the thing, anywhere from a day to 4 or 5 days. So you can't even get out there. One of the things that we would suggest to folks is to do some sanitation, that stuff that's too ripe or whatnot, still get it out of the garden, because anything that's sitting there is drawing them. But the problem has been is that they know there's food there. They can communicate to their nest mates that there's food there, and they are really quite problematic. Again, one of the tricks you might consider is as it cools down, the few days you got left to pick is pick the cool mornings where you can go out and pick before they show up. Once it gets above 50 degrees and the like, then their activity is really going to peak. But again, I think the good news to some degree is that we're getting late enough. This can't go on for more than another week or two. It just, as I said, we're at the end of their cycle. But you can see that there isn't a lot of food out there for them, so that's why they're so desperate to attack this ripe fruit.
Yeah. Patty, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist, a guest today, and you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email the talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Just a quick note, at the top of the hour today at noon, we'll be talking about spiders. Have you been seeing more spiders lately? Well, it's their mating season, and we'll learn more about the life of spiders and how they choose their mate starting at noon today. But right now, Phil Pelletieri talking generally about insects. We've got creepy crawlies in some homes. Fall's the time for that to happen. And we have lots of callers online already, Phil. And Sandy in Eau Claire has a question, I believe, about wasps. Let's go there. Hi, Sandy.
Hello there. Say, this is an off-season wasp question, but our house is just a couple years old, and we have a deck that comes out off the second level. And the wasps have, we watch them fly, and we know they're, you know, in down between the boards. So we know they're housing or something in there. And at, you know, times we'll spray, and they come up and, you know, just die right out on the deck. But we're looking at a way to maybe prevent them from deciding to take up a residence in there in the first place and be a little proactive next summer.
So they're under the the deck?
Yeah, you know. Yeah, well, it's a raised deck. It's on the second level.
I got
it. And they're in between the boards. So if we go down below and look up, we can't see them because there's one level of boards, and then there's, you know, some space. And then when we see them go down from the top, and they're when we spray, you know, it's just kind of hard to know where to spray even. You know, they just kind of crawl up from all over.
So at a given time, if you were sitting there just kind of quietly and watching, do you notice a lot of activity, like lots of critters going into a certain area? Or what I might suggest is we got to pinpoint this a little bit more. I'm not sure if these are paper wasps that have found a void, and so we have a big nest with a lot of critters as things go on, or are these the small umbrella wasp type things, you know, Polistes is what I know them as, that make those little tiny nests, maybe about the size of a 2 inches in diameter. And they often will be on overhangs and underneath things, but you would think that would be visible to you. What I'm fishing for is if they're crawling up underneath something, that would be what you want to take advantage of again. And you don't have to spray the outer surfaces. You spray up into those cracks and crevices, or you can dust into the cracks and crevices, or you can seal the cracks and crevices. I mean, there's got to be some physical opening that they're utilizing. The thing about sealing things is it really is a permanent solution. One of the things, you know, I have known in my career some people that are just fantastic at figuring out how to build critters out, but it's not a talent that everybody has. And you know, so it's kind of sit and watch, observe, see if you can have the insects give you a hint that might make it, again, a more permanent solution, because there's got to be a way they're weaseling through. And the other thing is treatments. Most of these things start with queens in May. And so treating in the spring when things are just getting started usually is the most effective, whereas you get later in the season, the numbers go up and things get a little bit more difficult to keep under control.
Yeah, and on a deck, you probably got little spaces between boards.
Yeah, but, you know, there's got to be some kind of void space.
Yeah,
that they're making, as I said, you know, you can really call these all paper wasps because the ones that make the little umbrella wasps still use the same kind of carton. It's just the sheer numbers of critters. You have 40 in a colony for one. You have 3,000 in the colony of a different species, that kind of thing.
Sandy, there you go. Thank you for calling. David in St. Croix County will turn to you now. Hi, David.
Hey, say, I was wondering if you could talk about the life cycle of deer flies. It is interesting the time they come out and then the time they leave and their habits of they can just be relentless on you. But once they get into a vehicle, they don't pay attention to you at all. They just want out, whereas a mosquito will just go for you all the time.
Yeah. So we have, honestly, over 24 different species of deer and horse flies in the state. The cycle is pretty much the same. Their maggots are predators usually in lowlands and wet, swampy ground where they feed on critters in the ground. The adults come out, and the adults are extremely visual creatures, and so they tend to patrol, and they are attracted to movement. And so some people might notice sometimes that you're driving your car down a lane and whatnot, and you look behind you, there's this cloud of deer flies because they're seeing the movement that's coming about. Unlike mosquitoes that are using more chemical senses like carbon dioxide and the like to find their host, these things are looking for visual stuff. But because of where they breed, it's a problem because you can have deer flies in you know, on your lake property that I can point a half a mile down the road where the source is, and you really can't do anything about the source. So it's not as if there's a magic there. You keep things covered. There used to be, and I don't know if it's still on the market, there was a retired engineer from Evinrude in the state that investigated that the USDA had played around with deer fly traps. And they're basically, if you think of a dark ball hanging from a tripod, and the movement of that dark ball attracts the deer flies, and then they put a cone on the top. So when they flew up to go towards the light, they got captured in there. And what he found is in certain circumstances, you could put these up and you could really reduce the number. In fact, the reason he got into this is his wife liked horses. The horses would be bothered and, of course, can even be dangerous with the horses bolting because of horse flies coming after them. and he would put these out in the pasture and catch lots of horse flies and deer flies. So there are some traps, they're not guaranteed to work, but in some circumstances they can help reduce the numbers. There's also a cute little design of a little sticky trap that you put on your hat, and when the deer fly lands on your hat, it gets caught. Treadknot was one that was sold. I've seen some other ones in catalogs and whatnot as a way of at least helping a bit. But you're right. The interesting thing is when you get them a confined situation, they don't like to come in, first of all. That's not their nature. And when they do, they're interested in going out. They're not interested in feeding at all.
David, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. I was looking, and I think there might still be that item that you were talking about, Phil.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me that somebody has picked up the idea, because as I said, it was well researched by USDA, and you know, it's a non-toxic way of reducing the numbers, realizing that you're kind of dealing with the ones that are patrolling the area where you've got the trap. That's the best you can do.
Jerry in Windsor, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that we've had great success knocking down the box elder population, sprinkling a bit of diatomaceous earth. It kills them right off. It's pretty innocuous and very inexpensive.
Yeah, if you use it right. You know, so the whole thing about diatomaceous earth is you've got to get it into places where the critters like to hide. It works as an abrasive. It's kind of like natural sandpaper. And what it does is it wears off the outer protective wax on an insect, which makes it susceptible to drying out and other things. And it's semi-permanent. It's even to the point that they use diatomaceous earth, or there's a synthetic version called silica aerogel, that in some houses in California, they would put it into the wall voids to make them insect-proof, because any critter that was foolish enough to get in there would be taken care of. And other than, you know, you don't want to breathe large amounts of this dust. It's like any dust is not good for you. But it is a real interesting way if you understand how it works. Now, people who put diatomaceous earth out on their broccoli to kill the green worms doesn't work so well because it just brushes off. It doesn't force itself on the insect in a way that causes the kind of skin abrasion. But if you've got a confined space, it is extremely effective.
Jerry, thanks much for calling. And let's turn to Karen in Oregon. Hi, Karen. Karen, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What's on your mind?
So I have these little black spots on the left side. And the neighbors think I've only been there for months.
You're breaking up, but I think I've got the gist of it. Karen has, because this happened to me when I had a lake home, Karen has a light-sided house, and on the house are black dots.
Okay, so it could be one of two things, and we got to sort it through because the direction is somewhat different. It is true that spiders and other insects at times can waste, even box elder bugs, honestly have kind of a liquid, darkish waste that almost comes on like varnish and dries. So you get some staining. But I'll be honest with you, most of the time when I see little black spots on the sides of houses, instead of being insect-related, they are from something called artillery fungus. It's a fungus that grows on wood chips and the like, and as its name implies, it shoots its spores, and they're sticky, and they're dark, and they stick, and they are very difficult to get off. Now, where you find the spots, if it's the pattern all around your security light, then it's, you know, spiders and critters related, and we can deal with that. You know, one of the arguments that we use sometimes is rather than putting the security light on a building and attracting the critters there, you put the security light on a pole, you shine it on the house, but then all the critters go out to the pole. So that's one thought. The artillery fungus gets a little more difficult. Again, it might be worth doing a little bit of a search on the internet. I have seen people come up with solutions that supposedly help getting it off, although I haven't been overly impressed when I've tried that. Some of it sometimes is you have to take the mulch off away from areas so that you don't get any more of this fungus. So, as I said, the pattern that you've got, if they're totally surround the house, I'm suspicious it's artillery fungus. If it's very localized, especially around windows and other things that have light at night that could attract insects, then it might be critter-related.
Karen, thank you very much for calling, and good luck. Appreciate it. Doug in Madison, your turn. Hi, Doug.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. This is kind of a crossover hybrid call. I know you're not an ornithologist, you're an entomologist, but I think there's some connection possibly here. My family members have a home that has wood siding, and they're getting woodpeckers that are building cavities this time of year. I told them they couldn't be nesting. They don't nest this time of year. It must be insects under their siding, but they're not seeing any insects. So they got a permit. They've killed like 3 downy woodpeckers. I'm not a fan of that, and they want to do more. But I was wondering what signs could be that they're so deep that you wouldn't actually see like the box elders or the ladybird beetles under the siding.
The most common problem that I see related to woodpeckers and insects is honestly solitary bees. And in particular, cedar siding, some of it, we had notorious problems. And what gives it away is the pattern. Is, you know, if you see lines of woodpecker holes, and they're pretty predictable along there, what we found out, and I know Dr. Craven and I and others have pondered on this one, is that when they make certain kinds of siding, there are little straw-like holes on the bottom that are the artifact of making the stuff. These kinds of bees literally use straw-like devices in nature for their nests. So they're putting pollen in or whatever they're after. They put their eggs in there and their grubs develop, and that's what the woodpeckers are after. You know, woodpeckers normally in trees are after the grubs of various kinds of beetles, but the wood on the siding of the house is too dry to be suitable for beetle breeding, but it is the leafcutter bees and there's some other critters. There's some other wasps that I could see doing this. So they said the pattern would be. So now, if indeed that's the case, if you look from the bottom of the siding and look up and see where those holes are, I know this sounds tedious, but to go through and plug all those so that the insects can't get there, if the insects can't get there, the woodpeckers will stop bothering it. So if it is insect-related, that's what I historically had seen quite a bit. We literally even talked to the manufacturers about this but we were told that really they couldn't stop that from happening, you know, having those environments that my bees would try to take advantage of.
So what would you, I'm trying to think of the easy way, some kind of a little foam injection or?
Yeah, or, you know, a little putty. I mean, they aren't very big holes, you know, and you know, the trouble is, though, is you've got to go along every board, you know, and come from the underside, and that's what you're looking for. And as I said, the giveaway will be the pattern of the holes. If you know, it's classically in a line. Because, again, the hole goes up, the grubs are in a line, and that's what the woodpeckers are taking advantage of.
All right. Doug, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Gary in Ladysmith, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I know you talked about post-powdered beetles earlier, but I had a few more questions. What conditions make them go dormant, and how long do I have if I bring the firewood inside before they would emerge, if they do?
So the difficult thing is that there's a lot of other bark beetles that make little small holes and make sawdust and the like. What you typically find is that wood in the first 2 years of cutting have this first wave of critters, and it doesn't have powder post beetle. Where I get the powder post beetle complaints are people that saw their own raw lumber or the like, or use logs for construction. And, you know, they store it in a barn for 3 or 4 years, and then they use it for whatever in building, and now I've got the insects coming out of the flooring and the like. So they're in well-seasoned wood. There's a group of them that attack softwoods. There's a group of them that attack hardwoods, especially the old, bigger vessel woods like oak and ash and the like. So I'm not overly concerned for powder post beetle. And then the other argument in your favor that you will not have a problem is that they need rough lumber to attack. Now, they can attack it 30 years later. Their success will depend on the moisture and the starch content of the wood. But anything that is painted, sealed, varnished, or the like, before they get there, they can't get in because they have to lay their eggs in open vessels. Now, the problem with rough sod type stuff that isn't sealed, they can come on to it. The other interesting thing is powder post beetles you see in barns, you see in unheated cabins quite successful. You don't see them in year-round structures really very often because we dry our wood out so much. But you don't get that drying effect in an unheated barn or an unheated cabin, or when it's only heated, you know, a week, a year in the winter type of thing. And there are treatments for that. So I'd be careful. And the other thing that will sometimes help you in determining, so when you cut a log and you see holes in it, most of the time you cut them at kind of an angle, so they're kind of oval or the like. Powder post beetle, when you see them come out of wood, it is a round BB hole right at you because they're coming out with the grain of the wood. So sometimes you can read that into it of which it would be. But the good news is that powder post beetles, I mean, they're frustrating if you put a new floor and they come out of the wood and the like. But generally speaking, they're a relatively minor problem, except in unheating cabins, especially log cabins sometimes the problem is that the wood needs to be resealed and refinished in a way so that we keep the critters out.
Gary, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Natalie and Toma emailed us. They have a one-inch segmented crawling worm-type critters that appear every fall in Natalie's garage. They curl into kind of a circular shape and crunch when stepped on. She wonders what they are and how to get rid of them.
Okay, so they're millipedes, and millipedes are a soil creature, and they spend most of their time, but they go through a migratory phase, and they can crawl a long ways. And so where your house is situated, so they're crawling around at night, and what happens when the sun comes up, they're looking for places that are cool and damp. So they'll congregate on the north side of the house, but they also commonly congregate on slabs and the like and coming into the garage. Now, spraying them there is kind of worthless. You just kind of sweep and get rid of them. If you consider you have to treat, I'm not even worried so much about lawns, but typically where we see, if you have a big field next to you with a lot of organic matter, that's where they're migrating from. And at extreme cases, people sometimes will spray a barrier along the edge of their property to basically intercept them out away from the house and kill them before they get in. Normally, if you had to do that, I would say early September. We're late enough now, I don't really see you're going to get much advantage of it. And you might know which side of your property is the most likely to be the source. Sometimes it's real easy. And you know, it's interesting because, you know, in the city where we just don't have that kind of organic matter in our soil or environments, you see a couple millipedes, but you don't get these herds of them. Versus I have seen places where there's just buckets of them coming in, migrating from adjacent ground in particular.
Oh, wow. Nick in Madison. Well, on that happy note, let's go to Nick in Madison. Hi, Nick.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I bought a house a number of years ago, have had the same tenants in for many years. They finally moved out. We've emptied the house. And I stopped in at night, and I was surprised that there was an infestation of cockroaches. And now the house is vacant, and I'm looking to figure out how I'm going to get rid of them.
Okay. Roaches aren't so bad. I mean, you just have to, they're both sprays and baits that you can use, you know, depending what you're more comfortable with. The thing about most of the roaches that we have is they need water. So I would guess that the problem is pretty much in the kitchen, maybe the bathroom. And what you have to do is kind of open up the cupboards underneath the sink and spray back in those cracks and crevices where they're hiding. Or, as I said, you can consider using some of the baits that are out there. It depends on numbers. If you said, you know, when you walked in there, you saw 50 of them, I'd say, boy, I think I would go after and spray. If you saw 4 or 5, then you might consider the baits. Baits take a little bit longer, but I'm guessing there's just not a whole lot of food available, so that would tend to cause cockroaches more likely to be exposed to the baits.
Oh, there you go, Nick. Thank you for calling. And Isaac in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Isaac.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. A number of years ago, I purchased some heirloom tobacco seeds off the internet, and I grew this tobacco. And white flies seem to just gravitate towards this. And I no longer grow tobacco, but I cannot get rid of the white flies that seem to gather under tomato leaves, bee balm leaves, Culver's root. What can I do about this?
Okay, so typically when I hear white flies, I think of a critter that is a greenhouse critter. And it's something you can bring in on transplants, and then once it gets in your backyard, it can go after it. And they love tomatoes. I mean, tomatoes is always on the top of the list. But the thing about white flies in Wisconsin is they're tropical. And so when the winter comes, they die. And so my question would be, how are you introducing them every year to have this kind of problem? If it's on the other hand, there are some fuzzy white aphids and stuff we run into, but typically they don't have the wide host range of plants. So, I mean, it your pattern fits white flies, but what's hard for me to explain is do you get buy transplants in the spring from somebody?
We usually get, tomatoes from a local greenhouse.
Okay, I don't want to point fingers, but to me the source is, I wonder if they've had a white fly problem, and small numbers of white flies are getting transported that way, because as I said, the thing about white flies is undersides of leaves, the adults are what you see flying, but their immature stage is almost a scale-like creature that's attached to the bottom side of the leaves. So it might be worth looking at, if you've got any of those plants still there, is taking them and just seeing if you see these scales. And even after the critters hatch and emerge, there's a little crust-like scale left behind, and that would verify that they're true white flies. And as I said, the only way to explain them in our climate is you keep reintroducing them in the spring from transplants.
Isaac, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, our guest today. You can call in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. If you call, we'll get you on pretty quickly. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, as we talk insects. Tomorrow, it's a book club day. The book title is Beyond the Flames, and the author, a retired firefighter from a Milwaukee area, uses his experience in the field to write stories about others who have this important job. We'll also hear about the training it takes to be a firefighter, and then we'll get a preview of the Wisconsin Book Festival. Right now, Insects with Phil. Bob in Solon Springs has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for the topic. Thanks, Phil. I have a question about an insecticide, a natural insecticide that we used to use at my fish camp in Alaska. And it used to be readily available in Seattle and throughout the state of Alaska. And it was really effective on mosquitoes. And it was called Buhack. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not. I don't know if it was sold in Wisconsin. It's been out of business now, I think, for about 15 years. The active ingredient was pyrethrum. And the story was that it all came from some chrysanthemum plant in Africa. And we would take this powder, and they said you could sprinkle it around for various insects and ticks. But what we would do is put it in the little tin on the top of the can and burn it. And you could just watch the mosquitoes in the windowsill die, and even the bottle flies. And now that it's illegal, probably because of health concerns, et cetera, I'm wondering if there's another comparable pyrethrum dust product that could be used in the same way.
Okay, so pyrethrum is not illegal. Pyrethrum is the natural insecticide from chrysanthemums, and although that company might not market it, I can guarantee you can find pyrethrum dust and pyrethrum spray still on the market. The newer chemicals are synthetic pyrethroids. They do not occur in the chrysanthemum, and the problem with natural pyrethrum is it breaks down in sunlight very quickly. And so the chemists have tweaked the chemicals, and now the synthetics last much longer, but have many of the same traits. Very quick knockdown, tend to be relatively non-toxic to everything but fish. Fish have a hard time with it. Now, my question, the burning of it starts to get into some pretty uncharted territory, because I can't tell you what happens. Although, with that in mind, whether you have ever heard of the product Thermocell, which is this little device you put on your belt, and it uses gas heating a coil, and you put a little pad, and it gives off this smoke and the like. That's the same thing, except they're using synthetic pyrethroids instead of natural pyrethrum. In fact, you can even buy units to put on, let's say, a table when you're out eating and the like, and it will have this small cloud of insecticide that knocks things down. And you wouldn't want to use it in an environment where you don't have fresh air. I mean, you see outside, it's much more reasonable. It's not something made for using indoors. But so I think there are products that are very similar and are designed in a way that you don't have to burn them like you did before to get the same effect. And Thermacell is just one brand. There might be other ones, but I know that's one. I spent a lot of time in the fall, or I belong to an archery club, but we're in the middle of a swamp, and we do have mosquito problems. And most of us have these little belt units that we use to try to keep the mosquito numbers down when we're out shooting our arrows. So.
Bob, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. And Mike and Stevens Point, on to you now. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Give me some advice about how to deal with Asian ladybugs. I have huge infestations that come in this time of the year.
Okay. I can't give you a prediction yet because I just haven't seen enough to know, but we haven't got to the conditions, at least in the Madison area. Historically, what you find is you get the first relatively hard freeze, and it's like you turn a light on. The first good sunny day, the next day, all heck breaks loose. And these things migrate in from large distances. You notice they particularly attack the sunny side of the house. Like so many of these fall invaders, you know, we try to get people to think through, is there something you could seal or adjust? Now, if you got an old farmhouse, that isn't going to be possible. But, you know, when I'd have people call me and say, you know, I get 50 Asian lady beetles every day in my bathroom, but nowhere else, then I start wondering, is the vent fan screened properly? Or is there some physical weakness out there that we could seal up so they can't get access? But in those cases, when they can't be built out, then there are sprays, and again, it's all these synthetic pyrethroids we've talked about, which is the dominant spray in the market. And as far as timing, for some of the early things like cluster flies, the person sprayed in August, that was good. That's way too early for Asian lady beetle. I wouldn't say at least until the 1st of October. And as I said, you're still okay here. I'm wondering in some parts of the north if the season has already started. Again, without running the lab, I don't get statewide calls like I used to, so I can't tell you. But have you seen Asian lady beetles in big numbers around your structure yet today or even this last week?
Yeah, just the last couple of days after we've had a frost.
Okay, yeah, so now, that's, you know, as quick as you can get it on. And your overhangs, the south side up high is where you want to get these sprays on. Again, around particular window frames, if you're a little concerned about those being tight enough, you don't have to spray every square inch, but the whole secret is to knock them down. And you get some as much repellency as kill out of these chemicals, to be honest. But if they don't come in, that's what we're after.
Yep. Good luck, Mike. Thank you very much for calling. And we turn to Bob in Washburn next. Hi, Bob.
Well, good morning. Thank you for talking to me.
Sure.
I'm sitting in my garage here dealing with the gladiola bulbs that I just brought in and thinking about how I could better manage the thrips that are a big problem for me over the summer.
Thrips.
Thrips, notorious little critters. You wouldn't think anything that small could cause a problem, but think of their mouths are little files, and what they do is they rasp the surface of the plant, and if it happens to be flowers and they love flowers, it affects it. To be honest, gladiolas, the thrips associated with it, if I remember correctly, overwinter in the bulbs. So those little stinkers are right there to go and start things. I had a brother-in-law that used to commercially raise them, and he used to literally dust his bulbs when he put them away and stored them, cleaning them up and the like as his first line of defense. Then he would wait into the growing season, and, you know, you watch your plants, and when you see the first sign of thrips, you put treatments on, and there are various treatments you can use. The thing about thrip control on green plants is because the way their life cycle works, you almost got to spray every 5 days for a total of almost 3 sprays to really get the knockdown, because there are life stages that are not susceptible at any given time. And so you have to kind of keep after them to kind of bleed them out. But as I said, I think it'd be worth looking on the internet to see if you can pick up some dusts that are labeled for thrip control in GLADS. And you might consider, you know, storing them with that, and that may be able to shut things down before they get a chance. Thrips naturally have some natural control, but if the numbers start high, then things get really out of hand.
Bob, good luck with that. Thank you so much for calling. Sue in Madison emailed, German wasps have created a nest in the ground next to their back porch, and she's wondering if they will come back and use the same nest the next year.
Generally not. That's not their normal behavior, but what would be a good idea is either this fall or next spring, whatever that opening was, I'd make sure it was sealed so it wasn't available. But it is not their normal behavior in our climate to recolonize a nest. Now, down in Florida, if you want to think about a real nightmare, is their yellow jackets don't necessarily get killed out in the winter. And so the next year, you can have a colony that's 10 times the size of the one from the year before. And that, I can't imagine. It's not real common, but it is capable. But we don't have those kind of problems up here, thank goodness.
Yeah. Fran emailed us. They have a 93-year-old log cabin in northwest Wisconsin trying to control powder post beetles for a number of years. Their current focus is on original white birch staircase. In the past, they've used penetrating on any bark covered with white birch furniture and supports in the cabin. They're now using polyurethane varnish. The question is poly versus penetrate and the best way to apply either.
So one of the ways that they have treated is to basically use, there's a product that's called penetrate that basically is a form of boric acid. And the idea is it soaks into the wood, and when the powder post beetles come out, they feed on it. In order to soak in the wood's got to be open vesseled. So as I said, if it's already painted or sealed, the penetrate won't do what you want it to do, because what it needs to do is soak in the wood, have the crystals there, and become poisonous to anything that eats it. Versus the polyurethane is just a physical barrier. And what my concern is that may slow them down quite a bit. But powder post beetles, if there's ones that are in the wood, you put the polyurethane on the top, it pushes its way out, and honestly, that hole is now an access point for new ones to go in to lay new eggs. They're not near as successful. It definitely slows them up, but that's frustrating for people. And the other thing that's crazy about powder post beetles is sometimes they take as much as 4 or 5 years to come out of the wood after it's treated, the other side of this is the drier things are, the more hostile it will be for them. As the wood ages and dries, it becomes more hostile. But I can't give you a magic date when it gets old enough that it's not susceptible. So, as I said, it may, thinking through, if you're using any of the borate-type treatments, it's got to be able to soak into the wood to be effective. If things are sealed in a way that can soak in the wood, then don't go that direction.
Tom and Ms., one quick last one. Tom from McQuantico emailed, runs in the state forest a lot, and during the heat of August and September, he would get bothered by gnats. What are they going for? Mosquitoes, he understands, but what are the gnats looking for?
Well, there are blood-feeding gnats. I mean, black fly is a classic one, and although most black fly problems are the spring, we do have fall ones. There are also little gnats, no-see-ums and whatnot, which is really a blood-feeding gnat. And again, they're kind of like mosquitoes. I mean, they home in on carbon dioxide and the like, and they're looking for a blood meal. And if you're there, now, if you're a fast enough runner, maybe. But I think that's what it is. And I would guess black fly first would have to see it. No-see-ums are pretty weak flyers, and I don't think they could catch up to you. So,
Phil, on that note, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us, and I hope we get the chance to talk again soon. Thanks, Phil.
Bye now.
Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. Well, we are turning our attention next to spiders, and we've got a guy who's spider. I'd call him the Spider-Man, actually. He's done a lot of research, even on spider brains. What do you think about that? We'll talk about the life cycles and a whole lot more about spiders. Coming up next, I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Well, we could probably listen to that entire children's song and learn about the life cycle of the spider, but I'd rather talk about it with our next guest today, because he knows a whole lot about the world of spiders. Rafa Lucas Rodriguez, back with us. He is an associate professor of biological sciences at UW-Milwaukee. And as we talk with him, we're going to cover the gamut here. I hope you'll join in. Maybe you can talk about spider behavior that you have observed, maybe in or around your home. Maybe you've seen a very colorful spider in your backyard, maybe recently. Give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Rafa, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Happy to be here. Thank you for hosting me.
I'm sure we're all familiar with spiders as we've seen them in our homes, outside our offices, other places. But what maybe a general description of what spiders are and what they look like varies an awful lot.
Yeah, there's a common pattern and then a lot of variation built upon that pattern. So the basic body plan of a spider is two segments, as opposed to insects that have three segments. So an insect would be head, thorax, abdomen. In spiders, the head and the thorax are fused in a single abdomen, and that's called the cephalothorax or the carapace. And then there's an abdomen, and those two segments are connected by a thin pterosaur. And then they have eight legs that they use to walk that come out of the cephalothorax. And then they have an extra pair of modified legs that are part of the mouth parts that they use. Those are called the pedipalps. That's the basic construction of a spider.
Yeah.
And then you have very super long legs, or some that are much chubbier. Some build webs. A lot of them build webs. Some just walk around and hunt.
And the size, I mean, the smallest, I mean, a flea jumping spider, that's about the size, what, of a grain of rice?
They get even smaller than that. You can get them as large as the bird hunting tarantulas. That are like the plate-sized, or the huntsman spiders in Australia. They're even bigger than that. And then you get some miniature spiders that you can barely see. They'd be even smaller than a grain of rice.
Wow. And here in Wisconsin, I think probably our biggest is the fishing spider.
Yeah, those get pretty big. That's about as big as I've seen it around here.
Yeah, I think they get maybe 3 inches long or something like that. It's plenty long. You may be noticing more spiders as you listen here on the show around your home and outside, and maybe that's because it's their mating season. Raf, how does a spider choose its mate? Maybe does it depend on the size of the web or the best web or something?
The reason you might be seeing more around nowadays is, they're on the web. They're normally on their web. They're minding their own business. But when males search out to find mates, then they start walking around looking for females. And that's the extra walking around that people might be noticing around at this season. The males will be looking for chemical traces of females to follow, to try and find the females. All spiders, as they walk around, they sort of continuously lay down a safety thread, safety silk thread. And that has identifying pheromones, identifying chemical features. So males can tell this is a female, try and find her. Then once a male has found a female, they're in the business of courting her, trying to be accepted by her. And in spiders, that is a very delicate topic, because the vast majority of spiders are predatory, so they're pretty good predators, And the vast majority of spiders, the females are larger than the male. So a male approaching a female is not only asking to be accepted in courtship, is also hoping not to get eaten. And rejection can often be the not get lost, but get eaten. So it's a very delicate approach. Court assess her attitude towards him. And then the features that they assess in courtship, those vary hugely between different groups of spiders. Some like jumping spiders are visual. So they have very, very beautiful dances. They move their legs around. They move their abdomens. Some that are more less visual, more web oriented, they use vibrations along the web to they send signals along the web to court females. So that's a whole universe of exploration to do with how courtship happens in spiders.
Well, I was thinking back to my earlier days. I guess I've been rejected by females from time to time, but I never thought any other would want to kill me. So that's a kind of a dangerous situation for a male spider to be in. So,
and there's the common myth that they often end up eaten, or that the males are sort of just not they have no hope. That's true for a few species where if a male finds a female and is very unlikely to find another female, then they not only don't try to escape, they sort of offer themselves as a food item for the female. But in most of the cases, most of the species, he's trying to live to tell another tale, to live to find another female.
Well, sometimes it works. Jack in Eagle River has a question. Let's go there. Jack, hi.
Hi, thank you. Just curious, because I've had a discussion with other friends about this. Are there brown recluse spiders in Wisconsin?
Are there brown recluse spiders in Wisconsin, Rafa?
Very few. I used to live in Missouri before coming here. And in Missouri, it'd be a daily occurrence. There, the basement was crawling in them. Here, I think you do get them, but very much rarer. And as there's increasing, their range might be shifting north a bit.
Yeah, and sometimes they might get carried in on other plants or something that you purchase from somewhere further south. I know my daughter's in Kansas, and they have plenty of brown recluse there for sure. But I read a piece that by a scientist who happened to be living in an area with brown recluse, and they had them in the house all the time, and he said they never were bitten.
No, they'll try and get out of your way. If they bite, it would hurt, but. I lived in a log cabin in a log house, and I saw several per day. That's if you're seeing several per day, there's a lot more. Never got bitten. Never had any problem. You'd have to like step on one barefoot or go grab one. Then they're not gonna come after you.
Yeah. Jack,
I know a professor that used to work do research on brown recluses, and she had her colony in her basement, just reared them there for her research.
Jack, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Steve in Evansville, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. My question is about wolf spiders. We live out in the country, and we have wolf spiders a lot. And I learned that they are nocturnal. And if you go out in the woods and you shine your flashlight, you'll see their little eyes shining back at you, and we've done that, and it's amazing how many there are. And I guess my question is how do they hunt? What do they hunt? I find them fascinating.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. Rafa?
They're just looking around for small arthropod prey. They'll hunt on the ground. They'll hunt on plant surfaces. And the eye shine that you see, that's a cool story. They have a reflective surface behind their eye that reflects light back. So they get better vision at night. It's called the tapetum. So that's what allows the eye shine to be particularly noticeable. And it is a freak if you go out at night with a light. It's just all of a sudden the floor is covered in ashine looking back at you. They also saw their, you know, they have good night vision because of that. But a lot of spiders also sense vibrations from the substrate. So whatever you're standing, you know, they have almost call it an arsenal of sensory structures that sense deflections of their legs, deflections of their body that pick up vibrations from the substrate. So a lot of the hunting they do is orientated by the pattern of movement of the prey, even if they're not seeing them.
Hmm. Steve, great. Thank you very much for calling. Elsa in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Elsa.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is about what I've heard are called cellar spiders. They look like a long-legged, almost like a daddy long legs, and I'm not even sure they're classified as spiders. I was curious what their life cycle is.
Those are, my PhD student is working with cellar spiders right now. There's two kinds of arachnids that get the name daddy long legs. There's the cellar spiders, and you can see those have the one segment is the cephalothorax, 8 very long, very elegant legs, and then an abdomen. And the abdomen is also kind of almost rectangular. It's very, also very elegant. And then the other organism that gets called that is they're a different order of arachnids. They're called opilionids or harvestmen is another common name. And those also tend to have, especially around here, most of the species we get are very long-legged. Also it legs, but only one body segment. So it's like one big command capsule and then long legs coming out. The cellar spiders are interesting because they're a species that is, there's a big family of in that group there. It's the family Falcidae. And you get some in the woods, you get some in natural areas. But there's a species that we call cellar spider that are associated with humans. So their main habitat is our houses, our basements. And they have their entire cycle there. The females will lay eggs on the web. The baby spiderlings hatch. Second stage, they start building their own webs independently. And they live the entire life in your house. So nowadays, the hunting males, you'll see like particularly large cellar spiders walking around, not on a web. Those are the males looking for females.
And I've read somewhere, it might have been the DNR magazine had a little piece, and they said, you know, it's not a bad thing if you've got cellar spiders. They might be. It's a good thing, isn't it? Explain.
Yeah. Well, they have the webs they build. They catch other arthropod prey in the house. So they catch the centipedes that you often see around here, other insects. So they're actually doing reducing the insects and other arthropods from the household. Yeah, like we don't normally allow many spiders, many webs in the house, but we leave the cellar spiders undisturbed, except when my PhD students come collect my basement is a collecting site for.
Okay. Elsa, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. There is a DNR magazine publication out. I always like the DNR magazine. And the fall 2025 edition has a story. It's titled "Autumn is for Arachnids," and a nice piece on spiders. And it's a good magazine anyway. So the DNR magazine. So it's worth a look. Our guest, Rafa Lucas Rodriguez, professor of are you an associate or a full professor?
Full professor.
Okay. Professor of Biological Sciences at UW-Madison, our guest. Great to have him with us here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller. If you missed part of our show, or maybe you just want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives at wpr.org/Larry to hear recordings of our broadcasts. Right now, we're talking spiders with Rafa Lucas Rodriguez, professor of biological sciences at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. It's great to have him back with us. And you can join in, email or at WPR.org, I should say, or give a call at 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Mary in Madison has a question. Mary, hi.
Hello. Excuse me. Hello. Yes, I was wondering if spiders eat dust mites. I know dust mites are spiders in that.
Do spiders eat dust mites?
I don't know. There's got to be some spider that goes after them, but I don't know specifically.
But dust mites are not spiders, right?
No, they're a different order. Like, you know, we talked about there's the spiders are an order of arachnid, mm-hmm. a different order are harvestmen. Different order, the mites are belong to the order that ticks belong to. So they're kind of, ticks are kind of mite.
Okay. Mary, thank you for calling. Nate in Lake Mills, your turn. Hi, Nate.
Hey, the year before last, in the autumn, around this time, I all of a sudden dropped from a tree this bright orange spider. It looked like one of those kids' orange rings, you know, spider rings.
Yeah.
And I didn't think it was real at first. And then it started moving, and then I was like, wow, that's a spider. But I've never seen anything like that. Where is that from and whatever? I mean.
Sure.
Was it like a very fat orange abdomen?
Yeah, it was big, like I almost saw it was black widow sized.
Huh. That's
big. I don't think it would be that big. Do you? Or what am I saying? I should ask you. As a black widow.
Oh, no. These, if it's what I'm imagining, they're bigger than a black widow.
Oh,
they're,
okay.
At least the abdomen is wider than a black widow. With spiders, you need to use key to identify them, and it's mostly looking at the features of the genitalia. But I've seen one around here that so you do get a species like that. They're part of the family of orb weavers, like you know, garden spiders and others. It's probably something called the arabesque orb weaver, Neoscona arabesca, but I would need to be able to look at it under a scope to be sure.
But it's an orb weaver.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Nate, there you go. Thank you. Vicki in Eau Claire, on to you. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. I have a question about when I do yard work, if I'm rolling over a rock, and there's a spider under there, appears to have like a white egg sac it's carrying. So I'm curious if this is the mating season, is that really an egg sac it's carrying or what would that be?
Yeah, it could be. There's some spiders carry the egg sac in their mouth parts. Then the whole time then the female is keeping the conditions right for the eggs. And she doesn't feed that whole time. Other species, they carry it with their the appendages that they use to spin web, so they carry it at the tip of the abdomen. Do you remember, was it at the hanging from the back of the spider or the front?
Appears to be on the back as they scurry away.
Uh-huh. That there's wolf spiders do that. I don't know. I'm not sure that is an example. It was a case of a wolf spider, but there's common species around here that are wolf spiders that you'd see them carry the egg sacs in their abdomen, at the back of their abdomen, the tip of their abdomen.
Yeah, probably. Could likely have been, Vicki. Thank you for calling. Vivian in Green Bay. Hi.
Hello. I try to peacefully coexist with all animal life, and so therefore I have spiders in my home, particularly a few of what I call kitchen spiders. They're very light colored, very fine, long, you know, they have longer legs, but their bodies are not really big. They're such a light color, sometimes you might think they're transparent. But one morning I got up and there was one in the tiniest amount of water in my dish strainer, all shriveled up. And I'm kind of curious, so I thought, well, I wonder if it's really dead. So I took it out of there, held it in the palm of my hand for a while, and just, you know, put it close to my teeth to warm it up. Well, it woke up or revived. I thought, all right, now what do I do with it? I should feed it, right? So I had some canned cat food. I put it on the counter with the spider. No interest. Okay, what else have I got? I have steamed whitefish. Put that on the counter, and it did eat the whitefish. I have a video. And so I just went about my business, and the spider did too. But as I tell the story, other people are, oh, wow. And, you know, they're used to killing or running from spiders. But now I have a niece who took a spider out of her car and put it down, and my daughter is no longer squishing every spider she sees. So the story has helped a little so we can coexist.
Vivian, I think you got it right. Rafa, what do you think?
Yeah, we can definitely coexist. Especially if that was sounded like the cellar spiders we were talking about.
Yeah.
Those are absolutely no harm to humans. And I kind of, you know, they're kind of nice to look at, and the webs are kind of nice. Like, they add a little ambience to select the corners of the house.
Yeah, that's a great story, Vivian. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you mentioned biting, and we've had a few emails relating to spiders. And do spiders actually bite and cause damage to us? They'll bite other insects maybe, but not so much us.
Yeah, they're all, except for one species that we know of, they're all predators. And they have their mouth parts, the biting mouth parts are interesting. You think of insects, they have single piece mandibles, is one segment that moves. Spiders, each the fangs have two components, so they're like their fangs are elbowed, and then there's the piercing part, and they all inject some kind of venom to subdue their prey as they bite. But you know, if we what's most likely to happen is we inadvertently pick one up and we scare it, then it goes to be defensive or step on it or something like that. They're not none of them are trying to come at us. They're not thinking of feeding on us or anything like that. But yeah, there's several where it would hurt, you'd notice it. And in some cases, there's some that are actually dangerous for humans. You don't, you know, for example, black widows, that can get you into trouble. But like the way people get bitten by black widows is they're working at some construction site, or like there's debris in the garage, and you reach underneath to grab it and lift it, and then you squish the spider, and then it's purely accidental.
And black widows, we don't have black widows in Wisconsin, do we? Or do we?
There's brown widows that we get in Wisconsin. No black widows. Although I had a student that collected black widows in Oregon and worked with them here, but he graduated, so now we're back to no black widows in Wisconsin.
Okay, Marilyn in Verona, it's your turn. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
My husband and I have restored the prairie around our house. We have several acres of prairie. That's about 30 years old. And we used to have an abundance of spiders once the prairie became mature, especially what we called garden spiders, yellow and black spiders. And I love them. And I've noticed that since we've been burning, we have noticed a major decline in the numbers of spiders, and we really miss them. And so I'm wondering if there's a better time to burn the prairie based on the life cycle of the spiders. We typically would burn in the spring. What's the advice of the guest?
That I have no knowledge to offer advice. Because, you know, you've got to do the burning to to keep the prairie as prairie. If you, and I'm not sure that's necessarily that causing a decline. It could be like some different yearly patterns of weather. No, there I better say I don't know than start guessing.
Okay. All right, Marilyn. Thanks for calling. Martha in Hawkins, we'll go to you. Hi, Martha.
Hi. I have a story about black widows. Not black widows, brown recluse. I had a coworker, a lovely woman, who got bit by a spider, and medically and so on, they decided that it was a black, brown recluse. And she didn't go to the doctor right away because, you know, spider bite, why would you? And it got necrotic around it, and so she went like 2 weeks after she was bit, and they gave her antibiotics, and she had this big sore on her leg. And as time went by, she ended up nearly dying several times in about 4 or 5 years. And, you know, went to the hospital with some kind of liver problem that almost killed her. And then she went and had, I don't know, something that left her pretty well debilitated. She couldn't think anymore. She could hardly walk. And this was all because of that spider bite. It was apparently, I think, it attacked her nervous system in the long run. You know, it goes through the system. Well, it kind of attacked all her systems.
Where did she live?
Actually, this was in Colorado.
Oh, Colorado.
And she was cleaning out brush around her apartment condo. And she eventually died about 5 years after she was bit.
Wow. That's horrible.
Yeah, that's very bad. And as we, it's, as you were saying earlier, it's rarely, I mean, they don't really want to bite you unless they think they're getting attacked in some fashion. So, and it's terrible to hear about that. But Martha, thank you for sharing the story. You can join in too, by the way. Number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Josh called, couldn't stay with us, wondering if daddy longlegs have a poisonous bite.
They all do for their prey, but not they wouldn't do us any harm. The daddy longlegs cellular spiders. But they're all in the business of subduing prey. And not, you know, firstly, part of the bite of the prey is subdue it. They have different species have different sequences of wrapping them in silk, then biting, or biting first and wrapping them in silk. But then the way that they eat their prey is they inject digestive enzymes that liquefy the prey in the body of the insect. Then they suck it back. So that, you know, they're all doing really mean things to their insect prey. And in some cases, they can be dangerous to us, but not the daddy long legs.
You have studied...
Yeah, I'm much less comfortable with brown recluses in the house than I am with cellar spiders in the house.
You have studied spiders' brains, and we I think we've talked about it the last time you were on, but you've studied their memories and ability to count. Talk about maybe that research, and then does their memory come into play during the mate selection process?
Ah, I don't know. That's interesting. So a lot of the work we do is sort of, you know, like if you think about it in principle, a spider could be the classic example of how we used to think of animal behavior, like a robot system of pre-wired input-output responses, right? So how spiders build a web is long sequences of repeated motions, and then you get a wonderful web architecture. But it could be super simple repetitions of movements. And then once they're on the web, you know, like the web snares a fly, then sends vibration. The spider could be simply in the business of here's a stimulus, or go to that stimulus, eat the insect, right? But it turns out that they have a lot of, they have a lot of knowledge about their web, about the layout of the web, about the content of the web that they store in their memory. So give you a sense of one of the experiments we do. There's a species of orb weaver. You get relatives here, but this is a big one that you get in the southern US and in Central America. And the way they capture prey is they'll subdue it, wrap it in silk, then bring it to the center of the web, the hub, and hang it from a single silk thread, and then they start to eat it. So you can do experiments where you give them different numbers of prey, so they accumulate different numbers in the web, each of them hanging from a single thread. So they kind of have a larder of, you know, hanging hams hanging from their web. And then the experiment is give them different numbers of prey like that, and then steal them from them by just cutting that one silk. So at the end of the treatment, you have, you know, spiders that had captured 1, 2, 4 or whatever, and then went on to lose 1, 2, or 4. And there is no remnant in the web to say there used to be something here, right? There's no damage to the web. There's no hole. There's just the ham is gone. And then when you do that kind of experiment, you find this, they start searching, but not like they search for prey that fell on the web, which is sort of oriented to where the prey is. They're just walking around and around the web, tugging on it, getting feedback. They kind of even look angry. And they go on for you know, like if a spider loses prey in its web, and you know, like 30 seconds you haven't found it, it's gone. They go on for almost an hour searching. So then that searching behavior indicates they have a memory of, I had prey, it's gone, I'm looking for it. And they search longer for prey they prefer more. They search longer for higher counts of prey. So they have some sense for the number of prey items they had captured. So those experiments are a lot of fun to do because it's, you know, their spider behavior on the web is fun to watch. And watching them search angrily is even more fun.
So why do it? Why study it?
Part of that there's many different angles. My interest is trying to understand the behavioral capabilities and the cognitive capability, you know, the smarts, if you will, of animals with completely different brain designs than we have, right? There is nothing like a vertebrate brain. There's like 2 ganglia, very, very different, probably evolved from completely different ancestors. There's some debate about that, but likelihood is different, completely different origins to those brains that end up kind of being able to perform similar functions in the sense of make a mental model of the environment of the animal and the animal's position in that environment and pay attention to that mental model to navigate the world, right? To go about their business. So then if we can understand how those brains go about doing those things, that can better reflect on our understanding of how our brains do those things. That's the pure, like kind of curiosity-driven knowledge of the world kind of thing, which down the line brings a lot of, you know, sets up more applied developments, but I think what I tell myself is I'm in the business of creating problems for neuroscientists to figure out. Like, look, they can do this. Now you figure out how they do it.
Oh, man. Oh, and by the way, do you ever return that prey back to the mad spider who's running around trying to find his prey?
Yeah, well, not those individuals, but then afterwards they get a compensation treat.
Okay. Vincent Burlington, your turn. Hi, Vince.
Yes, good morning. I have a quick story for you. About 10, 15 years ago, I went to a spider identification class at the Cedarburg Bog Biological Station of UW of Milwaukee. And the instructor basically said something like, no matter what your neighbors tell you, we don't have any poisonous spiders in Wisconsin. And a lady in the class had a little vial, and she handed it to him, and she said, what is this spider? And he says, that's a brown recluse. Where did you get it? She said, I found it in my kitchen in Menominee Falls. And he said, had you been traveling lately? She said, yeah, I just got back from vacation from New Orleans. So the spider had hitchhiked in her luggage, and she found it, I think, dead in her kitchen. So he was a little surprised, but the mystery was solved why it had been up here. So I don't know if climate change in the future will have spiders migrate north, but that was an interesting little story that I was able to experience, if you will.
That's a great story, Vince. Thanks very much. And it does, it's probably why we occasionally will find one here in Wisconsin. But as Phil Pelletieri, the entomologist I had on before, if you were on, you've been on today, Rafa, he often said it's starting to feel like they moved the state of Missouri, got moved up to Wisconsin. there is some climate change going on.
Oh yeah, no question. And that's what you're seeing a lot of. Is, you know, a lot of modern day conservation efforts is not keeping the philosophy is trying to change from keeping things like they used to be to keeping things capable of receiving the new animals, the new organisms whose distributions are shifting northwards or southwards. That's an example of how you get bitten by a spider like that, right? You're just gathering your clothing. It was in the hotel and on the floor, and there's a spider there, right? So it pays to be careful.
Mike in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I had two quick questions. I want to preface the start, though, that I've been personally bitten by a brown recluse here in Wisconsin on the top of my foot, and it did dissolve away the skin to about the size of a quarter. And it just dissolved all the skin away. But it went away without any medication or anything. I felt good. I've also been bitten by a brown recluse in Texas about 10 years ago and a scorpion. But beyond that, so I have been personally bit by brown recluse here in Wisconsin. So they are here. Maybe rare, but they're here. But so my question actually is regarding what I thought was a banana spider, which I haven't seen in years. I used to love seeing those when I was a kid. But they're all over my yard, and it's not a banana spider, but it's about that same size. So it's got an abdomen about the size of a marble. And it's orangish yellow, but it doesn't have the black stripes on the abdomen, on the top of the abdomen, like a banana spider does. But it's about the same size and makes about the same size web. Now, maybe you could tell me what that spider is. I know it's a rough description. But in that same question there, I've been watching these spiders in my yard because I like to watch the spiders. And I've noticed they do not eat box elder bugs. None of the spiders in my yard will eat the box elder bugs or the stink bugs. And I was wondering if there's something specific that... why they don't like, even the big spiders, they don't like box elders or stink bugs, and I wish they did. But maybe you could tell me what the spider is and why they don't like certain bugs.
Sounds like an orb weaver in terms of the identification of some sort, Rafa.
Yeah, I was going to say that's probably as far as deep as I can go without properly looking at it, but is it an orbicular web? Is it an orb web?
Yeah. Very round, about the size of a marble on the abdomen, and you have orange and yellowish, kind of splotchy.
And the web is, what's the web look like?
The webs are pretty large. Like I said, I thought it was a banana spider because of the size of the web. It's probably got a 2-foot diameter web at least, and it's very much in your typical spider, more a triangle type looking web, the way it spread, at least the way in the flower gardens in my garden. But then it's not a very tight weave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that varies between species. If I had to guess, I'd probably say it's that arabesque orb weaver that another caller was talking about. But I would need to be able to look at it under a dissecting scope. For sure don't like stink bugs because what we smell in stink bugs is chemical defenses. that, you know, are an adaptation to protect them from some predators. So spiders have prey preferences. They'll go for, you know, if it's strongly chemically defended, they won't go for it. I would not have guessed box elder bugs had similar defenses, but they're closely related to stink bugs. So that would be like, you know, a preference to go for prey that are not chemically defended. A lot of the orbivores around here, they're catching mosquitoes and midges, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Rafa Lucas Rodriguez, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking spiders today with Rafa Rodriguez, professor of biological sciences at UW-Milwaukee, and Juniper in Washburn has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Juniper.
Hi. The earlier question about daddy longlegs made me think of this, but I know that cellar spiders do have a mild venom used just to subdue prey, but there's a myth that harvestman spiders in particular have a very venomous bite and that they're just too small to bite humans. So I was wondering if that was any part of that is true, if they have any sort of a venomous bite or if they just have chelicerae that they use to eat without venom glands.
Yes, the second option. That so the harvestmen are the single body segment, right? Just one globular chubby body and then the head legs. They can prey, but they're often also eating, you know, like dead organisms they find, that kind of thing. So yeah, no venom.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Rafa, I know you wanted to mention tree hoppers on the show today, and I saw a video on tree hoppers that was really cool in terms of their mating and so forth. And
Cool.
You're probably going to find more tree hoppers in the south or in southern climes, but we do have them here in Wisconsin, and they look pretty darn cool. Describe them.
So tree hoppers are a family of insects that they feed on the sap of plants. So they're sap-feeding insects. Their entire life is spent on their host plant. And the family is famous for having very weird shapes that, you know, the insect body plan is, you know, head, thorax, abdomen. And out of the thorax, they have weird projections that sometimes they look like they're little bits of plant debris. Sometimes they look like ants. But sometimes they're just doing their own thing. Completely, you know, super colorful, super interesting shapes. Some look like they have, you know, like satellite antennae with bulbs and spikes coming, bulbs coming out of the spikes. And they're a kind of insect that uses substrate-borne communication. So it's sound, but it's sound that they send along the stems of their host plants. So you have to tap into the movement of the substrate of the host plant to record it, to detect it. But those are so unlike what we normally think of as insect sounds. There's like crickets with their calls or like katydids, and they tend to be sort of something like ch-ch-ch-ch. Kind of thing, right? Simple, repetitive, relatively broadband. Treehoppers and other insects that use substrate-borne signals sound like it's more like bird song or whale song, super complex, a lot more vertebrate in structure. And they have male-female conversations. So a male that is searching for a mate will produce what's called an advertisement signal. It might sound, one species that we get here commonly sounds something like ew. And then if a female is on the plant where the male is signaling, and if she likes him, she will respond back. And for the species we get around here, the response sounds something like mmm. So there I start anthropomorphizing terribly, like she sounds like she's, how do you like this guy? Or, you know, he's kind of okay, but not that enthusiastic. It'll be like, or she doesn't reply. And then, so their systems of communication are much more complex than we normally connect with insects. And you can sort of give them questionnaires, like in psychology experiments. So you can, with playback experiments, you can say, how do you like this guy? She responds. I like this guy. She doesn't respond. So you can describe their mate preferences in a lot of detail. And yeah, you like, if you have anywhere where you have a bit of backyard adjacent to a bit of forest, there is, if you have nannyberry, if you're anywhere near the plant nannyberry, odds are you have tree hoppers on it.
And that I was that video, the video title was Code of the Tree Hopper, and it did contain audio that they were able to, you know, to get. And it's really fascinating sounds, as you were describing. It was really, really, really cool. I wondered, you know, we're now 2 or 3 minutes left here. Spiders use something, they have a unique organ to produce silk for webs. Spinneret or something like that?
Yeah, their appendages at the tip of the abdomen, at the back end of the abdomen. And they have, you know, silk glands that open up to those appendages. And that's so the spinnerets are like the spigots out of where the silk comes out of. They have a whole array of different kinds of silk glands that make different kinds of silk. Some are for support and structure. Some have sticky glue on them. Different species produce different kinds of, have different ways of making the insects be snared by the silk. Some use glue droplets. Some use just a mesh of a wire that they get caught in. And they have adaptations in their legs to control and move the silk as it comes out of the spinnerets. Some are amazing. If you watch tarantulas as they build, they lay down silk on their tunnels. Their spinnerets are so long that they look like fingers, and they can control them individually like we control our fingers. It's amazing.
Oh, and the silk itself is actually, I think I read in that DNR the DNR magazine for fall, that a spider's web silk is actually stronger than steel when you measure it by weight.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pure protein, and it's stronger than steel and yet more pliable, more bendable. So there's a lot of interest in the properties of silk and how you know, the biochemistry of how they achieve it, to then inform the design of products for human use. But yeah, when I was taking the spider class back in Costa Rica, my professor had collected, I made a little string. It was maybe 1/4 of an inch thick from silk he collected from the Nephila spiders, this big one that you get down south that have big green and black and yellow bodies. And he had a big old Isuzu Trooper. So he just tied the silk to the car, and we just pulled it with that thin a string of spider silk was strong enough to pull a big Isuzu Trooper.
Oh my gosh. Well, on that note, Rafa, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. I hope you'll come back and be with us again. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Anytime. I'm happy to. Thank you very much.
Rafa Lucas Rodriguez, professor of biological sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Great to have him with us. Good show today, as always, I think. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Thanks to our team that create our shows every day, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.